KQED. KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Rachel Miro in for Mina Kim. Coming up, single-payer health care. Earlier this week, Bernie Sanders unleashed another bill, but this time he's got 16 Democratic senators co-sponsoring, including most of those considering a run for president in 2020. Now, nobody believes this plan is going anywhere, not with Republicans dominating Capitol Hill and the White House. But we'll talk about the basic idea of the bill, Sanders' strategic intentions, and whether universal coverage has any appeal for the American public. That's all coming up after this news. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Rachel Miro in for Mina Kim. Here in California and now in Washington, D.C., with Bernie Sanders' new bill, single-payer health care has become a litmus test for the populist bona fides of progressives, regardless of whether there's any practical hope of passage, politically speaking. Republicans are in charge, and they see it as a non-starter. Establishment Democrats, like House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, see it as a non-starter. But there is some value to moving the needle of political conversation away from maintaining or dismantling Obamacare? That's the question we'll explore this hour with Kaiser Health News editor Elizabeth Rosenthal, a medical doctor and editor-in-chief at Kaiser Health News. She is a former correspondent for the New York Times and the author of An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. Thank you so much for being here, Elizabeth.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I thought we'd start, for the benefit of those who haven't had a chance to read the book yet, do you think we can, as individual Americans, take back the reins of our health care?
Yes, I think we can. That's why I wrote the book. I wanted a book that was hopeful. I guess now that we've seen the conversation move, maybe it should have been subtitled How We Can Take It Back, not just How You Can Take It Back. So I think there are a lot of moves that people can do at an individual level. But I think what we're seeing now is much more of a call for state and national action.
Well, speaking of national action, can you give us a rough or the elevator pitch for Bernie Sanders' plan? What is he proposing to do?
Well, it's hugely ambitious. It's kind of to give Americans everything they could possibly want in health care with no cost sharing and no out-of-pocket expense. So I guess the question, of course, that everyone asks, and which always comes up with single-payer plans, is, okay, great. We all want that, but how are you going to pay for it?
Well, I guess the way that we would pay for it, presuming we're sort of modeling this on the way other countries have done it, is to pay more through taxes. So it's just sort of shifting where the money comes from, when you pay, so to speak.
Yes, that's true. But it does far more than that, in the sense of when you have a single payer, you inevitably have some degree of price regulation and price control. So it's not kind of a one-to-one equation that all the money we're paying out now through premiums and deductibles automatically goes into higher taxes. Some of it will, but I think the big, you know, $24,000 or in our case, you know, $3 trillion question is, how much would you have to raise taxes in order to provide these benefits? And a secondary question is, can we really afford to provide everything that everyone wants? Or are we going to have to do what other countries have done, which is to say, okay, you know, there's certain core things we are going to provide and others that people will either have to pay a bit out of pocket for or find another type of insurance to cover, like dental care or eye care. Do we want to have co-payments to kind of act as a kind of break on how much care people use? Because I guess what the studies show is if you give people the option to have everything and anything at no cost, there are some people who kind of willy-nilly will get everything and anything, whether they really need it or not.
Well, you know, that's often said about, say, dental care or eye care, but oftentimes those things are not really sort of accessories, if you will. You really need the crown
sure.
replaced. that kind of
sure.
thing. Sure. What can you tell us about what Republicans have put on the table so far and to what extent that would go to providing some measure of reform for the things that people don't like about the American healthcare system?
Well, I think what we saw and what we've been seeing in the past 6 months is that the Republicans haven't put anything on the table that people find very satisfactory. All of the Congressional Budget Office scores on the Republican bills have found a huge number more people uninsured and premiums and deductibles going up. So that's not really a solution. I mean, people are out there demanding a solution at the town halls for the high prices they pay, for the complexity of our system, for the lack of ability to see a doctor when they need it. And the Republicans haven't provided a decent answer to, you know, what were some genuine problems with the ACA, and that need fixing. But there are many other ways to fix them than what the Republicans have come up with. But of course, at some point, I think what we're seeing now is people, they hear all the complicated Republican proposals. They're feeling many people overwhelmed by all these be all the stuff that they have to do when they see a doctor. They're feeling overwhelmed by bills. And so they're saying, OK, we want something just radically, really different. And what is that single payer? Now, single payer means a lot of different things in different countries. So but whatever you say about it, it is vastly simpler than what people are experiencing now.
What country's program most resembles Bernie Sanders' proposal? And if it's not the best or apparently most efficient affordable model out there, what other country would you suggest we all take a look at?
Well, I think, and as this is something that I go into in the book, I think that we will find a solution that's acceptable to Americans. I mean, many countries have single-payer systems, Canada, Japan, Britain, but they're all really different. You know, in some, the state owns the hospitals. In others, there's a negotiation process between doctors and health experts and the government about rate setting. That's a Japanese model. In others, they'll cover dental care. In others, they won't. So I think we have to find a solution that's kind of uniquely American, borrowing from all these different countries' experiences. And that may, since we say we value choice, we may want more choice. It may involve some negotiation. It probably, of course, will involve some negotiation with hospitals, with physicians, with device makers, with pharma, because those are huge business interests in our country. But we've avoided those conversations. Now we have to have them, whether we go to a full-blown single-payer system or whether we just say we got to get costs under control and we're going to do that with some kind of hard national look at the prices we pay.
Can you imagine that political conversation happening? I mean, in part, it hasn't happened because of big pharma and insurance companies lobbying in Washington, D.C.
Sure. And part of the problem, I think, before is our representatives in Washington heard from pharma. They heard from the American Medical Association and insurers. They didn't really hear from patients, right? There was no one really representing the patient's point of view. And voters were not healthcare voters. They weren't saying to their reps, hey, why did you cave to pharma lobbying? But I think what we saw at these town halls this spring when the Republican plans were on the table is voters for the first time getting that all this kind of complicated policy gobbledygook in Washington trickles down to their healthcare. You know, they, if the Republicans were going to squeeze back Medicaid and take away that Obamacare expansion, a lot of people at those town halls were for the first time realizing, hey, that's my insurance. That's my kid who's going to be left vulnerable. And so I think we all as voters and as citizens have to become much more savvy about these kind of arcane policy issues and hold our representatives' feet to the fire. And that's why I think, you know, yes, Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All is essentially what it is, single-payer proposal, is hugely ambitious. No one thinks it's going to be, or if you think it's going to be, the end point of the discussion. But importantly, it's raising people's awareness of options. And I think people are going to start voting for their health care interests, because when we do surveys at Kaiser Health News and Kaiser Family Foundation, health care costs, pharmaceutical costs, they're a number one issue for American families. They're an essential pocketbook issue. They're why maybe you can't afford a family vacation. They're the leading cost of bankruptcy. They're why you're reported to credit agencies. I mean, this is the essential pocketbook issue for Americans right now, and we have to deal with it.
Well, but are we willing to deal with it? And I'm speaking here of the individual voter as grown-ups, because you see polls where people will say, oh, yeah, you know, single-payer health care sounds good to me, but, you know, you might have to raise taxes for that. Oh, in that case, definitely not. I mean, like, there seems to be a desire, perhaps like Bernie Sanders' plan, to have it all without paying for it.
Well, when people are, I mean, Americans are allergic to taxes, right? We know that. Every popular proposition is lower my taxes. But I would ask every American to add up all their medical expenses now. How much are they paying in premiums? How much are they paying in out-of-pocket costs? How much are they paying for pharmaceuticals that their insurance doesn't cover? And see how much of your family income that adds up to. In other countries where there's been a national tax assessment to cover healthcare, like in Germany, it's about 16%. Half of that is paid by the individual, 16% of family income or personal income, half paid by the individual, half paid by the employer if you're employed. I would venture to say that there are a lot of Americans out there now paying more than 16% of their income for healthcare, or it's actually more than 8% of their income for healthcare. So let's try and think rationally about this and not emotionally. And I think, you know, when people say, oh, we can't do real healthcare reform and say, oh, we're going to raise your taxes, we're going to raise your taxes, we got to get around kind of the buzzwords that people are so reactive to in this country, like raise my taxes, like single payer, like socialized medicine. You know, we don't have to choose any of those things. We will find a uniquely American solution. I'm sure of that. But it will involve some tough choices, Americans paying more in taxes, some pullback of money from pharma, from hospitals. But it's not going to be imposed by fiat. It has to be imposed by a political agreement, which we all participate in. And I want to point out that other countries have made this transition. When you look north to Canada, I think we should remember that their system, which is very popular now, is only about 50 years old. You know, it grew out of many of the same kinds of problems we're experiencing now. It was opposed wildly by doctors, by insurance companies and big businesses in the 50s and early 60s. But guess what? In surveys, the most popular person in Canadian history is not, you know, Wayne Gretzky or Justin Bieber. It's Tommy Douglas, who was the person in Saskatchewan who first introduced a hospital insurance program for all Canadians.
Well, we'll have to fact check that. But practically speaking,
yeah.
I mean, you know, If we're not talking about universally expanding Medicare in 4 years or however many years,
right,
is there another way of sort of cracking this nut?
Well, there are certainly less rapid and more kind of gradualist approaches to this. And I think that may be where we end up, you know, is this kind of very ambitious single payer program a kind of means to just get people thinking outside the box? And will it do so? Will it open new conversations? I think it can't but do so. So sure, you could say, as Hillary Clinton did at the end of the presidential campaign, let's try and lower the Medicare age every few years. You know, if you did that over a period of a few decades, you would have essentially a single-payer system, because Medicare is a single-payer system. We forget about that. You could say we're going to do some kind of price rationalization. You know, even that, it doesn't sound very radical, but it's been completely off the table in the U.S. We'll let Medicare negotiate drug prices. Again, that's gone nowhere so far. But now we see a bunch of states. I mean, Maryland has a bill in play that's supposed to take effect October 1st to ask drug companies to report planned price increases and to be able to say, you can't do that. This is for generics right now. But I think slowly we're going to get to the idea that we need to rationalize prices. And that doesn't mean, you know, someone coming in by fiat and saying, oh, you can only charge $300 for an appendectomy. It means often, as it does in Japan, as I mentioned, a bunch of really smart people, including the medical industry, get together and say, what makes sense to charge for this test, like an MRI? In our country, you know, some people get away with charging $20,000. Some people charge $500. So I think that crazy kind of price variation, which is unique to the U.S., will be resolved and has to be resolved in some kind of way that doesn't necessarily have to be a single-payer system, but it does have to be some national, large-scale thinking about rationalizing healthcare.
And you're convinced it has to be national as opposed to starting with a state or letting states experiment, as Republicans have suggested?
No. I think it certainly can start with the states. You know, one of the things I see as a model is look at issues like gay marriage, assisted suicide, smoking bans. Those started with state initiatives. And I think the states are really important testing grounds. But what you can't do is have it be what it is right now with, you know, millions of little negotiations because no one has the power. If a state takes charge and starts to look at drug pricing, for example, you know, they have a lot of purchasing power and they're representing tens of millions of people. So that's where you have power to say to one of the drug makers, you know, that Hep C drug isn't worth that much and you can't charge that much in our state. And even more so, because that's kind of a leap beyond where we are now. Say to a generic drug maker who takes an old drug like doxycycline, a very old antibiotic, and raises the price 1,000%. Can't do that in our state. We're not going to allow it.
But it seems to prove very difficult to rein in those kind of price manipulators. And the bill you mentioned earlier in Maryland, you know, where basically the state demands some kind of prior notice from pharmaceutical companies mm-hmm. about drug price hikes. Something similar was tried here in California, and it ended up becoming a bill where it's like, it'd be nice if you gave us notice and try and justify it.
Right.
But it's not a discussion about controlling drug prices. It's just a notification. And, you know, there are tons of notifications. They don't change markets.
Right. And I think, you know, that was one of the things we see with insurance premiums. Part of the ACA was states had to notify, or plans had to notify, if they were going to hike premiums by 10%. I mean, first of all, I would say 10% is a lot. If you go up 10% every year, you're in big financial trouble really quickly with your premiums.
Especially also, if you don't have a salary that goes up 10% every year.
Of course. And you know, in many states, the insurance commissioner didn't have the power to say that's too much. In some states, they do. But even in states they do, they very rarely say that. So sure, this notification thing is very weak. The Maryland law actually includes being able to say no, not just notification. But of course, the big problem is the minute you have these laws, the financial interests come in and fight them tooth and nails, and they often get watered down, as did the provisions of the ACA. You know, people like to say the ACA wasn't strong enough in taking on pharma or hospitals or doctors groups, which it kind of wasn't to affect real pricing change. But part of that was this kind of endless negotiation of wanting buy-in from these sectors, and these sectors managed to get things watered down so that effectively their financial interests weren't harmed. Now, you know, as our national health care bill keeps going up and up, and as more and more costs are shifted onto employers, to employees in the form of rising premiums, and more importantly, these high deductible plans where people are paying the first $5,000 or $10,000 of their family's health care, I think we're going to see people saying, you know, notification isn't enough. We need real cost controls. And we're going to vote for those insurance commissioners who say no to rate hikes. And we want insurance commissioners appointed that are going to fight back against them. So, you know, again, voters need to get smart about this very complicated system. That's what I'm hoping to do here at Kaiser Health News, what I hope to do in the book, and start voting with their pocketbooks. And that's not happened yet. And well, it's very complicated, you know? People don't understand the connection.
It's incredibly complicated. This is like something out of, I don't know, Algebra 2, right?
Worse.
It's worse, yes. And
calculus.
It's very hard to read the differences. There are so many different players. It's different from state to state. I want to continue on that line in just a moment, but I do want to put out the call to our listeners to join the conversation. The number to call, 866-733-6786. And now that you're ready to take that down with pen and paper, 866-733-6786. You can also email us. It's forum@kqed.org. We also monitor our Facebook page and Twitter. So also going back to what you said earlier about Tommy Douglas overcoming the Beeb in popularity in Canada, we did actually get some fact-checking on this from producer Irene Noguchi. So in 2004, Tommy Douglas was voted the greatest Canadian of all time in a CBC television poll. But the Beeb had not yet released his first full-length studio album. That was in 2010. So it's possible, you know, he wasn't on Canadian radars just yet. Yeah.
Okay.
And this, too,
Fair
I just
enough.
Have to add. In 2017, Tommy Douglas made the list of top 10 inspiring Canadians, and Justin Bieber was not on that list. So,
okay. he's a pretty popular guy, and maybe that's what Bernie Sanders is going for, to be like the Tommy Douglas of the U.S. Now, Tommy Douglas just kind of created the seed of the idea in Canada. He didn't take it national. He was in Saskatchewan.
Now, we're already getting comments. Pam writes, this is what I keep wondering. If you subtract all the money employers pay for health care, all the money providers have to charge to cover the uninsured that they treat, all the money patients pay, either in copays or self-insurance, isn't that all going to wind up covering most, if not all, of what single payer would cost? Has anybody done the math?
No, I haven't seen anyone do the math. And the problem is the math is scattered. Those numbers are scattered on kitchen tables across the U.S., right? We all know how much we spend out of pocket on health care. So I think the sum total is hard to come to. Also, I would point out, think of the amount of time that we all waste navigating those health care bills and explanation of benefits statements. So I think there's a good chance it would cover everyone. But it won't cover everyone for everything that they want all the time.
For everything that they want all the time. We're talking with Kaiser Health News editor Elizabeth Rosenthal, a medical doctor and editor-in-chief at Kaiser Health News, about single-payer health care. Join the conversation. Give us a ring at 866-733-6786. Post on our Facebook page. Email us, forum@kqed.org. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro, and we're talking about single-payer health care. Whether you like the plan Bernie Sanders introduced earlier this week, universal coverage has clearly captured the imagination of many Americans, and we've got someone here in studio to talk with us today about it who really knows her stuff, Kaiser Health News editor Elizabeth Rosenthal. Elizabeth, are you ready to take some calls?
Sure.
All right. Let's give it a go then with Michael in Oakland.
Hi. Just a moment ago, you guys were talking about the possibility of states moving to resolve our health care problems in the states. I am the most aggressive proponent of single payer you will find. I lived in country in Canada for a decade. It works. It's sane. It's simple. But there is no way a state, even a state as large and relatively prosperous as California, can do this alone, yet for no other reason than because as soon as you do that and you are eliminating the issue of pre-existing conditions and you are putting the bill into everyone's tax bill instead of on the individual payer, you're going to have people who in other states, especially in an Obamacare repeal scenario, cannot get coverage for incredibly expensive, difficult to manage, and particularly rare conditions, and will come flooding into the states because whatever the cost of property here is, it's cheaper than dealing with some horrendous genetic condition or some very difficult to treat cancer.
Interesting challenge. Elizabeth, thoughts?
Well, I mean, we already have that to some extent. I mean, the states have varying programs for people on Medicaid, for example, for people with disabilities. And of course, you know, you can move state to state, but that's much easier said than done. And Saskatchewan did move ahead in Canada before the other provinces. So I think, you know, we have dozens of excuses for why we're not moving ahead, and they're all valid to some extent. But I think they shouldn't be prohibited because we have to do something. So, sure, people could move to California, but I think quicker than that, other states would say, wow, this is working. We should try it too. I mean, look how rapidly we moved to from gay marriage being a state-by-state issue to a national agenda. That's what I hope would happen rather than people saying, wow, I have a very expensive condition like hemophilia or, you know, hep C, and so I'm going to move to a state that supports that better. I mean, we already see, and I already interview a bunch of people in the book, actually, who leave the U.S. and decide to return or take up residency or citizenship in other countries when they have things like type 1 diabetes, because those chronic conditions are so much better supported in Canada or Germany or Denmark.
And we've certainly heard, read headlines about medical tourism where people will just drop in on another country for a particular elective surgery.
Right, right. I call them healthcare refugees when you're moving whole hog. But it makes sense, really. If you're faced with an expensive chronic disease, people who can will make that move. But, you know, most people can't move. They have a lot of reasons why they live where they do.
Robert writes, single payer, be realistic. We don't have the votes. When women demanded suffrage over 100 years ago, they were told to be realistic. In the 1950s and early 60s, when blacks wanted a cup of coffee at Southern lunch counters or the right to vote, they were told to be realistic, but they don't have the votes in Congress. All great movements build support over time, so let's dispense with this kind of simplistic analysis. Let's go to the phones again and Win in Menlo Park.
Thank you. I believe that last comment is very relevant. I think single payer is a wonderful concept, but look at how complicated it was in 2016 to try and get the electorate to even look at that. Congress is made up of Republicans, and we're in the middle of a midterm election in which what we really need to do is change the balance of power. And if we put all of our major effort on trying to get a single payer before the electorate, I don't think they're going to understand it or focus on it. And the last thing I would like to say is I think that these issues of major consequence like this are better served in a 2020 election or a real election when we're going for a president instead of trying to do this in an interim election where the turnout is so low.
Do you think, Wynn, that Sanders et al., what they're trying to do is at least start the conversation in preparation for 2020?
I think it's a wonderful idea to start the conversation, but it's overwhelming, and then you can't bring to the practicality of what does that mean for 2018. It can't be the whole enchilada.
Thank you so much for your comments, Wynn. Let's go now to Ruth Ann in El Cerrito.
Good morning. I wanted to ask, I don't know if Elizabeth Rosenthal knows, the difference between Sanders' bill that's up now, just got released, S-1804, and John Conyers' Improved and Expanded Medicare for All bill, H.R. 676, which has over 100 co-sponsors and has been around for a while.
Yeah, I'm sorry I don't have the details of the differences. You know, we've seen Medicare for All or single-payer bills introduced year after year after year. I think what's notable is all the variants are getting more political support, you know, again, from a certain segment of the Democratic Party. But I think it's on the table now in a real way that it wasn't on before.
Thank you so much for that, Ruth Ann. We're all going to be Googling that later today.
Yeah.
Mark asks, why do we never hear the how will we pay for it when talking about anything that relates to the Pentagon, but only with social service and general welfare considerations? Kathy writes, coming from Australia, the system here is very confusing. From the outside, it looks like too many middlemen making money out of inefficiency. It also looks like insurance companies have medical practitioners over a barrel, and that most of them work for corporations because being in private practice would be a nightmare when it comes to complying with insurance. Do you agree with that assessment, Elizabeth?
Yes, I think nobody likes our current system. And I think one of the reasons why we're hearing a lot of talk about single payer now is there was a recent survey showed that for the first time, a majority of physicians approve of Medicare for All single payer. So that's a big change. You know, this was anathema to medical groups before, and it's still anathema to groups like the AMA, I think. But a lot of on-the-ground doctors are just as fed up with patients and dealing with this incredibly complex system, which by many estimates, you know, 30% of what we do is useless administrative overhead, which is really, you know, Medicare uses about 2% of its dollars on administration. Many insurers use far, far more. A single-payer system, whatever you think about it, it's much, much simpler and in that way saves a lot of money.
And when we talk about that administration cost, which is not 2%, we're talking about huge executive salaries, huge advertising budgets, things that may not be necessary to the well-being of the American population.
Yeah, it's advertising, it's executive salaries, even more than that. It's this constant stream of bills flying back and forth and, you know, like I said, a million individual negotiations where if you had a national price structure, you wouldn't have to negotiate. You wouldn't have to have your insurer speaking to your hospital, who speaks to your physician, who speaks to you, to figure out what would be paid. There would be a price and you would just pay it. It would be more like going to the supermarket and shopping for bread. You don't have to negotiate for a week to figure out what you owe.
And then you're not also paying what the company believes the market will bear for that bread.
And it's transparent. I mean, that's the other thing. You know, we hear over and over again, we're not really paid that much. That's the price you see on the bill. But of course, we're only paid 20% of that. Okay. Well, that would go away, too. All of that negotiation, which is so unhelpful for what we care about, which is what's good for patients.
Janet asks, since the current guest is from Kaiser Health News, a very important question for her is what happens to Kaiser in a single-payer healthcare system?
Well, I first of all have to point out that Kaiser Permanente and Kaiser Health News are totally different entities. We happen to have been started by the same family a long time ago. So we are an independent newsroom that has nothing to do with Kaiser Permanente. However, what does it do? It does what any hospital system and insurer does, depending on the single-payer plan we decide. I mean, in many countries, the hospitals and physicians are still operating for themselves. They're private entities. But when they submit bills, they submit them to the government, the single payer. So everyone can operate, but they just have to accept the prices that we're paying nationally. And instead of competing on price, or instead of charging $100,000 for a hip replacement, they might compete on, you know, well, these are our infection rates. They're better. We have a higher success rate for people who get hip replacements than hospital Y down the street.
So they would still be competitive. With that, let's go to Anne in Northern Virginia.
Hi. Yes, my husband and I are self-employed. We have a family of four. We have paid for private individual insurance for many years and just watched it climb and climb and climb. We have about a $9,000 deductible, and I was recently told by our insurance company that due to uncertainty in the market, they won't be offering individual plans anymore. And I'm at a point where I feel like we're the lost crowd, and I don't even know which reform to hope for at this point.
Yeah, I mean, these are the people who really were not served well by the Affordable Care Act. There were people who were kind of made too much money to get subsidies, are self-employed. These are the group that have seen their premiums skyrocketing, their out-of-pocket costs skyrocket. I don't know what your family pays for health care, but I would suspect that if we had an 8% tax that covered a single-payer system, you'd be saving a lot of money, and people like you would be saving a lot of money. Now, some people who are not taxed for their health care now, who have good employer coverage where their employer pays all the premiums, they'd end up paying more because their taxes would go up. But I think we have to think at a national level, and you know, the details will tell who pays more and who pays less.
And is it possible to presume, Elizabeth Rosenthal, that in a single-payer healthcare system, you would still have gradations in the quality or speed of the care based on your income? So wealthier people could, you know, pay more or pay extra to go to private practitioners to get elective surgeries, that kind of thing?
Well, that, again, depends on this is one of those devil is in the details questions. Certainly, you look at the NHS, you look at some of the European countries. There are small private systems that exist in parallel with the public system. So people who want to can pay more and get fancier rooms, maybe quicker care, can go to different sets of doctors. But, you know, the thing is, and I think the thing we have to remember is on all of those countries with national single-payer systems, those systems exist, but they're pretty small. People are pretty happy with these single-payer national systems. You know, there's nowhere where people have abandoned that single-payer system en masse and said, I really want private insurance.
Richard writes, please take a moment this segment to speak to the Graham-Cassidy repeal and replace bill that's moving in the Senate right now. It's off a lot of people's radar, and the discussion of single payer is taking up valuable attention from this immediate threat to health care.
Well, I think, you know, the Graham-Cassidy would allow states to do much more in the way of shrinking Medicaid, getting undoing some of the ACA provisions. So, yes, that is there. It's making its way through the congressional process. I don't think we think it's going anywhere, but I may be wrong with that. And so a lot of the onus really now sits on with the states to do the right thing for patients.
Earlier we had,
but I don't think the single payer discussion is a distraction, and I hope it's not the campaign issue for 2018. I think people are looking for 2020. I think in 2018, what we should be looking for and what we need are kind of these interim products, whether nationally or from the state, you know, better drug price negotiations, whether at the state or national level, insisting that insurance premiums can't go up willy-nilly, insisting that provider directories be accurate so that all of us who live within the current system and likely will have to, at least for a little while longer, have our pocketbooks better protected.
Earlier, we had a question about how to compare the Sanders bill with the Conyers bill. And, you know, an interesting point of comparison there would be as regards eligible providers. With Sanders' bill, it could be any licensed provider feeding into the system. With the Conyers bill, you must be public or not-for-profit, including staff model HMOs. So that is an interesting distinction there.
Yeah, I mean, there are some countries like Germany, which says that all insurers, what they call them, the sickness funds there, and they have to be not-for-profit. You know, one of the things we've seen in American healthcare, and this is largely the theme of the first half of my book, is that all of these institutions that were really charitable, not-for-profit, have moved to a for-profit model. I mean, look at hospitals. They're technically not-for-profit, but they have huge operating surpluses, and you go into these marble lobbies with art collections. They don't look like they're doing charity care, right? Also, insurers, which in the 20th century were largely, there were the blues that were not-for-profit. Now, most of them are for-profit. So I think that profit motive has really kind of insinuated itself into our healthcare. And one of the things we should be thinking about very seriously is whether we want it there and to what extent we want it there. The Affordable Care Act set up insurance cooperatives in a lot of states that were insurance companies that were not for profit. Unfortunately, the Republicans didn't give those cooperatives all of the money, the startup money that was promised, essentially. So a lot of them have failed. But I think that's an experiment that really deserves to be reinvigorated.
Let's go now to Michael Ann in Berkeley.
Yes, I am the director of Still Point Integrative Health Center in Lafayette. Mm-hmm. And this is a topic that's deep in my heart. I think we need to start calling this health coverage and not care, because it isn't. This whole conversation is about money, as Elizabeth is speaking to. As long as we're still in the conventional medical system, single payer isn't going to change things. People are voting with their feet and their dollars. They are turning away from conventional health care, which unfortunately is embedded with the insurance system and the pharmaceutical system. So let's call this a health coverage conversation and not a health care conversation.
Excellent point. Thank you, Michael Ann. Let's hear now from Daniel in Sebastopol.
Thank you. Well, one of the things I'm not hearing in the discussion about how to pay for it is the fact that we're spending about 16 to 18% of our whole gross national product on health care. And in all the countries that have a single-payer system, they spend about half that. So we would save at least 6% of GDP just by switching over to almost any kind of single-payer system. That's more than the entire military budget. It's a huge amount of money. It would grow our economy. We could have living wages, free tuition. We could rebuild our infrastructure if we chose. I won't say it paid for itself, but a lot of the money to move to a single-payer system would come from getting rid of the profiteering, the price gouging, the excessive costs that your guest was mentioning. And I think we need to start by saying the price tag is going to be a lot lower on a single-payer system.
Any comments you want to add to that, Elizabeth?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you know, when states say we can't afford this, we can't figure out how to pay for it, inherently, if you cut out a lot of that administrative waste and you go to a rationalized price schedule, you do bring costs down a lot. I think the other problem, though, which we have to deal with very seriously in this country, is that healthcare helped bring us out of the recession, right? So there are a lot of jobs doing not terribly useful in that inefficiency, in that those endless negotiations between your insurer and your doctor. So in many cities now, healthcare is the largest employer. And if we make healthcare into a much more efficient animal, which we should do, we have to do it carefully and think what happens to all the people employed in that sector and how they could be deployed more healthily in the name of health rather than healthcare administration, which we might not need under a single-payer system.
Thank you for that, Daniel. Rick asks, I have read in many places that single-payer will lower the quality of care and reduce the creativity that our medical system has. Who will develop the new antibiotics that are becoming more expensive by the day? Who will be denied care because they are too old?
Well, I don't think we see in single-payer systems denial of care. we see a lot much more rationalization. There are some machines, for example, which we have some advanced scanning machines, which we have dozens of in the U.S. And when someone in the National Health Service needs that machine, which they consider very rare, they get flown to the U.S. for it. So I think there's tremendous overuse in the United States. A single-payer system, a good single-payer system, gives people what they need. It gives people what is medically indicated, but not this stuff that's for sale, that's profitable, that we see so much of in the U.S. So, of course, again, devil in the details, how you do it, but that's not a reason for hesitating about moving to a different kind of system, a different kind of thinking about healthcare, whether it's single-payer or some kind of more rational pricing.
Peter writes, the idea that dental care can be divorced from medical care is truly dysfunctional. Lack of good dental health is perhaps the most egregious symptom of health uncaring, as he puts in quotes, foisted on the poor at the cost of massive suffering. And you know, this raises a good point that we've sort of developed a kind of a la carte concept with healthcare, where you know, lots, you know, an increasing number of things are just you know, put off the table as too expensive to give to everyone.
Yeah, I mean, when you talk about aging in America, what are the issues? It's often hearing loss, which is not covered, vision problems, which are covered kind of minimally, and dental care. So, sure, these are huge issues, which. Even many of the single-payer or national health systems don't deal with very well. And it's always been convenient to kind of think of them as different, but obviously they are part and parcel and probably the central issue for many older people in the world. So in other countries that have single-payer systems, there's often a supplementary insurance that covers these things. But again, with some price controls so that you don't end up paying an arm and a leg for insurance. Part of the problem here
is
not
Let me just break in briefly to say you are listening to Forum, and this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. So for more information about how to support KQED, please go to kqed.org. I'm Rachel Miro. Well, Elizabeth, let's go back to this question of other countries. I'm wondering, what is the practical reality? Let's say that, you know, I have an elderly relative who's dealing with a mental health care issue in Britain. Is she really going to be seen to, or is that something that is going to be less accessible in a system like that?
No, I think it's going to be more accessible. I had a very dear friend who died in England a couple of years ago with hospice care. You know, huge problem in this country, how to pay for hospice. I mean, there was someone from the NHS with him basically 24/7. It really was impressive, the kind of holistic view of health. Now, you might argue, okay, it took 6 months longer to get the newest cancer drug for stage 4 lung cancer in England. True, you know, they wanted to assess which patients would really benefit. But I think that kind of lower level care that's so important and so fundamental to maintaining health and the humanism of medicine is actually done much better in more single payer national systems, because there's much more incentive to keep you healthy. You know, one of our problems is we ask people to shop around and go on a new plan every year. Well, great. So why does my plan care what happens to me in 6 years if I ignore my weight or don't exercise or, you know, let my diabetes get out of control? I think this long-term, more humanistic, holistic view is financially smart for national health systems. It's not smart for a kind of fragmented system that we have now in terms of the financial incentives.
Let's hear now from Mina in Nevada City.
Hi. I think that one of the things that is hampering our current debate is that a lot of current health costs are hidden. For instance, the people with the really great employer plan are not shown just how much is coming off of their paycheck to pay for that employer plan. And also in some of the insurance billing, you know, where there's a low copay or Medi-Cal or something like that, you don't necessarily even see a bill. You pay your low copay, and you don't know how much was charged for that service. And I can't get a bill out of the dentist that shows me how much was charged for that service. And that's something that the doctors' associations could do something about so that we know what the true costs of the current system are, because they're a lot higher than people know.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really good point. I mean, I think there's intention in trying to keep those costs secret. That's why I encourage everyone to look at those explanation of benefits, even if you paid $200. I've been shocked when I started looking at them, discovering that the hospital billed $12,000 for my colonoscopy. Or when I went on book leave to write this book, I discovered, I was still working for the New York Times at that time, that they were paying, and I had to pay when I was on book leave, over $2,000 a month for my insurance. You know, those are like bright light moments where you kind of say, whoa, you know, we're spending a lot more than we know on health care. And people are want to say, oh, yeah, I love my health care, until they get sick, until they face those out-of-pocket costs, until they see those prices. And then they go, what?
What? Well, I want to thank you, Elizabeth Rosenthal, for helping to make sense of our healthcare system, our crazy, crazy healthcare system. Elizabeth Rosenthal is Kaiser Health News editor, doctor and editor in chief at Kaiser Health News, and she's been talking with us about universal healthcare here at Forum. Continue the conversation online. Head to kqed.org/forum. You're listening to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.